Good morning. It is Monday the 15th, tax day. Mr. Dalby is with us. You weren't training for the marathon.
No.
Okay. Boston Marathon, I guess we'll kick. Does it start at 11 o'clock local or noon?
Gosh, and I missed it this year.
Yeah, I got an email from a buddy.
Oh, I was going to go. I forgot about it.
Yeah. super local stuff, right? Or hyper local. Right. It's in a suburb of Boston that my buddy who has a radio station who's in a suburb, they do play-by-play of the Boston Marathon. Yeah, you know, all the different activities going on and that stuff. So they're probably in their pregame show right now. I guess it starts a little after 9 o'clock. Okay, Tom, you knock yourself. But they've done it for like 30 or 40 years, so they certainly have got it figured out. But it just, you know, some of those little local intricacies. Are you ready for your question?
All right, let's go.
All right, I'm going to avoid a Roman holiday just because it wouldn't feel right.
Okay.
All right.
He's looking for something to really beat me up on.
Why is something that's useless and expensive called a white elephant?
Oh.
Ooh.
Useless and expensive. The only thing I can think is going back to East India and, you know, the kings and white elephants. It's the only place I can think of, and I have no idea how it got there.
Well, you got dangerously close on that.
Right.
The term white elephant comes from ancient Siam, where no one but the king could ride or own a rare and sacred albino, or white elephant, without royal consent. The cost of keeping any elephant, white or otherwise, was tremendous, and when the king found displeasure with someone, he would make them a gift of a white elephant. And because the animal was sacred and couldn't be put to work, the cost of its upkeep would ruin its new owner.
Wow.
Yeah, killed with kindness, huh?
Yeah.
So now you got one for the record books, huh?
Yeah.
The next one, to foreshadow tomorrow, is Charlie Horse. Oh, I think we're more familiar with Charlie Horses than white elephants, but that's
right.
Okay.
I've had one or two.
Yeah. I keep hearing from folks in the area that business is becoming more and more challenging, you know, in a bunch of different sectors. And we certainly see it at the gas pumps with things, you know, the normal seasonal spike, but, you know, it's spiking from the top of the mountain now. Price of food and all the related ones, kind of the stymied nature of development, you know, in those related industries that aren't happening. What are some of the techniques or suggestions you would have for businesses that are facing some of these challenges right now that might be, I don't think they're systemic, I think everything is cyclical, but they're confronting some of these challenges?
Yeah, that's a really difficult question. I wish I knew the answer other than hold on. And try and survive.
Same theory as the tornado survival kit? Yeah.
Exactly.
Hold on. Yeah, okay.
You know, so the challenges you're talking about are multi-phase right now. You have, you know, the issue of virtually everything you buy, the cost has gone up. And if we go back the last 2 years, you know, it's anywhere from 18 to 20%. And so that portion of your income statement or the expense side of it, you know, 18% up, well, that's 18% off of your bottom line. You know, all that money comes right off the bottom line. Then you have the increase in, you know, your cost of wages. You know, as you're probably aware, in the state of California, fast food wages have now gone to a minimum of $20 an hour.
Have you seen that impact any of the local restaurants?
So I think what you're going to see is over time, it's not going to be instantaneous, but over time, anybody in the food services industry is going to have to start competing with that wage.
Even if it isn't the local
correct.
Folks.
You know,
yeah.
It's going to push things up. Will it push it up to $20 or more? I don't know. You know, these are all unprecedented things that are happening.
Well, and that particular one, did that impact wait staff? Or is that the hourly folks that are more in the fast food arena?
From what I understand, it's fast food, and it has to be 60 units or more, I mean, 60 locations or more. They don't have to be in California, so they can be across the country. So any franchise that has 60 or more it's applicable to, unless you bake bread.
Is it? Oh, so it's not Panera specifically, or exclusively?
Yeah. So if you bake bread, then it doesn't. It doesn't apply. And of course, we all know that was because
isn't that so Panera transparent?
Panera made a big donation to Gavin Newsom's campaign, and so they were excluded from the minimum wage. That might have impacted a few other businesses. I mean, Subway bakes their own bread, so I don't know if that is going to impact them.
Well, and how do they, you know, what is the standard for qualification? Is it like Arcata calls it, formula restaurants? Or is it something else? Or you start getting into that minutia and things kind of go sideways pretty quick.
Everything's always in the definition of the words.
Like white elephant.
Exactly.
KINS. News and Information Times, 8:30.
Murphy's Markets has everything you need to get through your day the healthy way. From drinks to snacks and everything in between, right now, Amy and Brian Coconut Water is only $1.99. Brew Dr. Kombucha drinks are also just $1.99. And Annie's Homegrown products are $2.49. A 6-ounce Yoplait yogurt is only 79 cents. And don't forget about Chicken of the Sea tuna, 4 for $5. Get a boost for your day by stopping by Murphy's Markets. More than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:34. We're back talking shop this morning with John Dalby, the bank dude from Redwood Capital. So as you're looking at the cost of businesses today and some structural things, we've got obviously a number of different components in that. You've got the wholesalers and distributors having to do battle like with gas prices and things of that nature, getting it to the retail setting. Then you've got at the consumer interface, how's that for a fancy phrase this morning? costs associated with that, either with labor or accepting these increased costs with transportation and inflation and then the challenge of limited resource, you know, can you get the product, so to speak? And then you got the consumer who's getting squozed. Okay, so we got this continuum that's going through for consumers. What are you sensing that's going on, and are local businesses able to adapt and pivot? Or I don't think holding your breath is necessarily a long-term strategy.
Yeah, as far as consumer confidence and the consumer's ability to spend on non-essential items. So what we have seen over the last couple of years is a shift from what was a high in savings. You know, the average savings account was much larger 2 years ago. Today, we've seen unprecedented levels of credit card debt. And so what does that tell you? It means that the increases in costs have been absorbed by the consumer by taking on debt.
Does that debt register with anyone? Does it show, or is it gross sales that is the focal point to determine whether or not an economy is healthy or vibrant or going?
So what generally, you know, in the if you're talking about the economic numbers, you know, it's something that's noted, but what you're looking at is consumer spending or consumer confidence. And so my point with that is the absorption or the shift from savings to debt can only take you so far. There's a point in which you can't borrow any more money to keep your lifestyle where it is. So I think we're going to see a significant drop off of consumer spending, you know, at the point in which people are no longer comfortable or have the ability to borrow more money, you know, on their credit cards or, you know, however they want to borrow.
Which is interesting. What didn't last week one of those dollar national chains say they were shutting down?
I hadn't seen that.
Oh, shoot. I forget what the name. It was one I didn't recognize. I think it was in Southern California, but mm-hmm. a fairly large regional where you would think that there might be migration towards some of those types of stores. It may not last you 10 years, but it'll suffice for the period of time that you need whatever the product is.
Yeah, and I can't speak to it because I don't know the details, right. But when you see a chain or a large chain of stores, you know, fold, it could be a number of things, including mismanagement. So to say that that's a sign of the economy, I don't know.
Could have been a trigger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it could be anything from, you know, the passing of management, you know, of ownership, et cetera. So I don't know anything about that story. Right. I'm just saying that there can be multiple causes. With that said, I think we're going to see some challenging times in retail. And, of course, we've seen an incredible shift. If you look at the history of this community, you know, when I first came here, you shopped downtown. You shopped in downtown in Old Town, and that's where you went if you wanted to spend
money. Now there's
a
parking lot there instead.
And now, you know, then came the Bayshore Mall, and we saw a shift
another shakeout
out of there.
That. Yeah.
And then, of course, now we've seen, with COVID, the advent of mail order. And that's always been eroding, but it really exacerbated it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to the point now where I'm guessing, but I wouldn't be surprised if over half of what people bought is online.
Yeah, our area had always been high in catalog purchasing, top five in the country kind of thing.
We've talked about that for years.
But now it's just moved into, I guess, electronic catalogs.
Yeah,
rather than the other. So we do have a history of being able to survive and compete against that sort of thing, but it was when there were industries that were employing, you know, the bases were large, and now with some of the cutbacks. I heard something, one of the programs this morning was saying that not working on Fridays is becoming more and more of a trend, a reality. I'm thinking, well, that's dandy, but somebody's got to work on Fridays, otherwise...
You know, we're going to
shut things down. Do you sense that our area is resilient enough because of either earthquakes, geographic separation, being in California, some of these things to be able to weather this? Or do you see that there's going to be a significant shakeout?
Well, we have been, in fact, we started tracking this years ago. We have always been relatively insulated from the state and national economies. And so...
Yeah, we're not boom and bust.
Yeah, if we went back 20 years, there was almost a complete isolation, meaning regardless of what the national economy and the state economy was doing, we were steady. We weren't great, but we were steady.
And predictability is a plus.
Right.
Yeah.
But as we've shifted from a resource-based economy, as we've moved away from that, we've started losing that insulation. We still have some. So if you see spikes and valleys in the national economy, you know, we're seeing hills and dales.
Right, because of the percentage of the government employment that we have in the area,
That's a big part of it.
Yeah.
And in fact, there is an economic index that is called EDS and MEDS, and it is how much of your economy is supported by schools, education, because those are insulated,
right.
And MEDS or physicians, hospitals, and medical care, because, again, those two industries are relatively insulated from recession. And so the more MEDS and EDS you have, the more insulated you're going to be.
It's interesting, the medical we both have got buddies, and one of us has personal experience. Mm-hmm. If you need something done, you're Healdsburg, you're Napa, you're in the Bay Area, you're leaving the area. And I understand that there's a lot more healthcare capacity. GPs, south. We still seem to have that, we're kind of in that squozed area of the continuum. And it is interesting because the demand is here. You know, try to get a new doc. how many years do you have to wait? Kind of thing. And that seems to be the reality, which you would think that there would be a backfill in to satisfy the demand.
Yeah, you're asking a very big question, and we'll probably have to answer it after the break.
Oh, fine. You want to do a time check, too? It's 8:43.
Something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now...
Meet Radio.
I keep forgetting I'm president.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:47. We're back talking shop this morning with John Dalby from Redwood Capital. What are you looking at on the national scene, other than the election, that might cause a trigger of something? I mentioned Jerome Powell before the show, and you mentioned another one of the cabinet members that don't seem to be in line with what experiences on Main Street. I think that's probably the easiest way to say it. So is there a single decision, determination, action that can be taken that is going to go from, it will bring down your perception of the stress that we all are experiencing down a couple notches?
Yeah, so there's the piece that we always think about interest rates, that the Fed controls interest rates, but they also control quantitative easing, and quantitative tightening, which is what they're exercising now. And the best way to describe quantitative easing is the printing of money. And so what the Fed
and
does...
And the other's burning money?
Yeah.
They're burning through a lot of money right now.
And so what the Fed does is, without money, they purchase bonds and Ginnie Mae certificates and other things and increase their portfolio of securities. And by doing so, they're increasing the money supply because they're buying it with dollars that don't exist. And that is, if we go back in the administrations, during the Obama administration, that is when the Federal Reserve had to do everything they could to stimulate the economy because it was declining. And that's when we went to an unprecedented low. Prior to that time, 1% for a Fed rate was considered the floor. Well, we went to 0 to 25, and so we went past anything that would through the bottom. That wasn't enough to stimulate the economy, and so they started quantitative easing, the printing of money, to try and stimulate things. Well, that during the next would be the Trump administration. During the Trump administration, they kept rates low, and they took the position that as bonds matured, they would just replace them. So they weren't increasing their holdings, but they weren't decreasing them. Now they're decreasing their holdings, and they've raised interest rates to slow the economy.
Are the two connected?
Theoretically, they both trigger economic activity or reduce it. And of course, the idea is to reduce economic activity to reduce inflation. So they look at two things, employment and inflation. And those are the two triggers to determine whether they go up or down.
So that's their benchmarks.
Correct.
So when we heard that employment went down last month, that was a bit of a shock to their system.
Correct.
Okay.
And then also inflation, the target is 2%. So even though inflation is down to 3.7%, and of course, you know, there's always the confusion. That doesn't mean prices have gone up 3.7% in the last 2 years. It means, you know, in the last year, you know, so it's a trailing index. You know, we've actually seen 18 to 20%, you know, in the last 2 years.
Because it's building on
right.
top
so
of.
So prices yeah. aren't coming down. They're just not accelerating at the same rate. Well, they want to see 2% or less in inflation.
Is that achievable?
It has been. That's where we were.
But with the increases that are structural coming from the government.
So the problem.
It seems like it would be at cross purposes.
Correct. And so, you know, once prices get up so high, you know, can they continue to go up? I don't know. I mean, you're going to have an issue with demand at some point in time.
Or the employment is really right. going to yeah. change significantly.
So I don't envy the decisions they have to make. But what we're waiting for is for rates to come down to try and stimulate the ability for people to buy homes again.
So if you and I can see that, and the national press can see that, or not people that are particularly informed about, you know, goes through their thought processes in their meetings. Why don't they see that?
Well, I think they do.
Or are they chasing the holy grail of low inflation?
So at the, well, it's not the holy grail. That's their charge is to get inflation down. And the question then becomes how do you do that? And do these means actually help with reducing inflation? But part of it is, as you know, fuel prices have escalated so much in the last 2 years, you know, and those are artificial. We have done that on purpose, increased fuel prices. That doesn't change unless you get to the point where fuel prices become stagnant. Then we can see, you know, the potential for inflation to come down. And so we're not going to see, if you look at after every Fed meeting, every member of the market committee puts a dot where they think rates are going to be. And if you look at those dots, that dot chart that comes out every meeting, you see that they believe rates are going to come down.
Is there a timeline associated with that?
That's the question, is how fast.
I guess we have something to talk about next month then. Thanks for coming by, bud. See everybody tomorrow.